I want to finish up what I was unable to finish last time. You remember that I had told you about a song that was probably not still popular when I was a boy, but a song that I heard, and at least one other member of the congregation was familiar with it. It was called Standing on the Corner, and the lyrics about standing on the corner watching all the girls go by, obviously thinking impure thoughts about the girls that he saw standing on the corner, because it says, "Brother, you can't go to jail for what you're thinking." That was when I heard the lyrics, I thought, well, that's in terms of what Jesus Christ said, that's impressive. You can't go to jail for what you're thinking. And remember that in the series of sermons that I've been giving for more than a year and will probably continue to do for a long time, we're concentrating on the specific commands of Jesus Christ, because Jesus said in John 15 and verse 12, "You are my friends." What a unique concept that people like us could be God's friends. You know, God goes out drinking or when he has a party, we're the people that he would want to invite. We are his friends. Who's on the guest list? Well, it's you and me. We are God's friends, he says, if you do whatever I have commanded you. He says, "I have called you friends, for all things that I heard from my Father I have made known to you." So, would Jesus say that you can't go to jail for what you're thinking, that you can't get in trouble for what you're thinking? On the contrary, Jesus in Matthew 5 and verse 27 said, "You have heard it that it was said to those of old, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you," now Jesus makes the law tougher and he raises the bar, "I say to you that whoever looks at a woman," who's ever standing on the corner, "to lust after her, has already committed adultery with her in his heart." So then he says, "If your right eye causes you to sin, pluck it out and cast it from you. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and cast it far from you. For it's more profitable for you that one of your members perish than for your whole body to be cast into hell." So Jesus is saying that, yeah, you can't go to jail for what you're thinking, but you can go to the lake of fire. That's hell. The Gehenna that he's talking about is a symbol of the lake of fire. So, a second time, Jesus has raised the bar on the Ten Commandments. We want to be the friends of Jesus Christ. We want to be the kind of people that Jesus Christ would not be reticent to sit down and talk to. We talked about how we might feel about sitting down next to a homeless man who hadn't had the opportunity to take a shower or change his clothes for a long time. We might have a little problem with that. We might be polite. We might sit there for a while, but after a while, we might want to get up. And Jesus is saying that the adulteries that proceed from the heart defile us. And Jesus doesn't want to keep company with people who are defiled by what they produce from their hearts. So, we talked about this age and how it's founded on the lust of the eyes and the lust of the flesh and the pride of life. It's all around us, and that these things are death traps. And Job knew that his eyes could cause him to sin. Job said, "I've made a covenant with my eyes. Why then should I look upon a young woman?" So we can't partake of everything that this world wants us to see. You can't watch everything that you see on TV. And I told you that in the past week before that, I had kind of been ambushed by a Hardee's commercial. You see a Hardee's commercial come on the air, you assume that's got to be wholesome. Maybe the food's not all that wholesome, but you would expect a commercial to be wholesome, wouldn't you? And yet there's three gorgeous women decked out in very skimpy bikinis trying to sell me a cheeseburger. The week before that, a Victoria's Secret commercial. I wouldn't walk into Victoria's Secret. I wouldn't browse through a Victoria's Secret catalog. So the world is full of images of immoral women and seductresses. And as I said, before the age of television, we would not have been exposed to this minuscule percentage of the population whose appearance, whose faces whose bodies are absolutely perfect. We just wouldn't see, you know, three or four or five people like that in a lifetime. But now they're on television and they're in movies, and and they're not wearing enough clothes, and this is the kind of images that it's available for everyone to see now, and that these things are death traps. So, how to prevent sin? That's the issue. And there was an old Tomorrow's World magazine from 1971 that I found that talks about how to prevent. There was an article in there, how to prevent sin. And it's a mental battle because sin begins in the mind. We can't win the battle without the help of God. Paul in Romans 7 said, "What I'm doing, I don't understand." This is Romans 7:15. This is one of my wife's favorite verses of Paul. When she paraphrases it, "I could if I should, but I don't and I won't." And I, Bonnie doesn't like to read Paul much. Paul says, "What I'm doing," I'm not reading it in the King James because, yeah, if I read it in the King James, Bonnie will just go off. "For what I'm doing, I don't understand. For that, what I will to do, I don't practice that. But what I hate, that's what I do. If then I do what I don't want to do, I agree that the law is good." So as I said before, I could if I would, and I should, but I won't because I don't. But whatever. It's very, very difficult when the mind is besieged with these images that we see on TV and in the movies. And in Romans 8 and verse 4, Paul says that the righteous requirement of the law might be fulfilled in us, who do not walk according to the flesh, but according to the Spirit. For those who live according to the flesh set their minds on the things of the flesh, but those who live according to the Spirit, the things of the Spirit. For to be carnally minded is death, and the world is filled with death traps, causing the things that cause us to lust, but to be spiritually minded is life and peace. Because the carnal mind is enmity against God. So if we want to be the friend of God, we can't have carnal minds. We got to have spiritual minds. So we have to avoid the, first of all, to avoid sin, we have to avoid the images that lead us, or that lead our minds into lust. The Spirit of God should be leading us to control and to monitor and to edit and to censor what we see. Daily, we have a choice to make. Are we going to be the friends of the world, or are we going to be the friends of God? The whole point of all these sermons is to be the friend of God. So let's look at James in chapter 4. James is also talking about lusts. James 4, "Where do wars and fights come from among you? Don't they come from your desires for pleasure that war in your members? You lust and you don't have. You murder and you covet and you cannot obtain. You fight and war, yet you don't have because you don't ask. You do ask, and you don't receive because you ask amiss, that you may spend it on your pleasures. Adulterers and adulteresses, don't you know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? Whoever therefore wants to be a friend of the world makes himself an enemy of God. Or do you think that the Scripture says in vain, the Spirit who dwells or that dwells in us yearns jealously?" So it's not possible to be the friend of God and of the world. God is jealous. You know, we think jealousy, oh, that's bad. Jealousy is a negative thing. Well, I think we confuse jealousy with envy. Envy is the desire to possess things that belong to somebody else. God is never guilty of envy. Envy is covetousness, and covetousness is sin. However, jealousy is something different. Jealousy is the zeal to protect and to continue to possess the things that are lawfully one's own. And God guards his possessions, in particular his people, with jealousy. Jealousy is the desire to retain exclusively that which is already one's own. God is a jealous God. He says that in Exodus 20. Verses 1 to 5. I'll just read you the part at the end. For I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God. This is talking about not paying homage, not worshiping other gods. God is jealous of our worship. We worship God, and God is jealous of that. He doesn't want that shared with anyone else. And the devil wants worship. Satan wants worship. Satan said that he to Christ that he would give him everything, all the kingdoms of the world in a moment of time. And when it said in a moment of time, it made me think, maybe he showed him all the kingdoms of the world, past, present, and future, in a moment of time. And Satan said to Jesus, all this you will have if you fall down and worship me. Well, God is jealous of the worship of his people. When Jesus was talking to the woman at the well, he told her that God is seeking people to worship him in truth and in righteousness. And God sought people to worship him, and he found us. God went searching for people to worship him, and he found us. And God is jealous of that worship. God doesn't want to share our worship or our affection with anything else, with any false god. God has a passionate desire that we would be his friends and that our friendship would not be shared with the world. And so we can't follow the lusts of the world and then continue to be the friends of God. So, how to prevent sin? The process of sin is threefold. Let's look at James 1. James 1 and verse 13. James said, let no one say when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he himself tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is drawn away by his own desires. And King James says lust. This is New King James. And enticed. And then when desire or lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, brings forth death. So as Jesus warned us, sin begins in the mind with wrong desires. And the gateway to the mind is the eye. Dwelling on the desire can cause a breakdown in the barriers that would have prevented us from committing the act. The more the mind dwells on the desire, the harder it becomes to resist. The mind cannot be emptied. The mind's like, it's like vacuum. You ever hear the expression, nature abhors a vacuum? Well, at least it does on planet Earth. If you try to evacuate a glass bottle, well, there's a lot of force and a lot of pressure looking to fill that bottle back up with air. And your mind is the same way. Your mind can't be a vacuum. I guess maybe unless you're practicing yoga and you can completely empty your mind of thoughts. I can't, especially when I'm trying to sleep. My mind fills up with all kinds of thoughts. Oh, sometimes it'll go on for 30 seconds until I can finally fall asleep. It's very easy for me to go to sleep, but Bonnie lies in bed and thinks and ponders and wonders and worries. Your mind continually has to have a thought in it, unless you're like me and you can go to sleep in less than a minute. I am awake now. I'm pretty sure I'm awake. All right, so your mind is like it constantly wants to gnaw on something. It wants to think about something. So the more the mind dwells on a desire, the harder that desire is to resist. The mind can't be empty. We might try to empty it, but it's going to fill right back up. So where our minds dwell on thoughts of lust, we must drive those thoughts out with thoughts of good things. So we have to have a list of something to think about when we're thinking about the wrong things. We need to turn that thing off. Start thinking about that thing over there. And Philippians talks about this. Philippians 4 and verse 8. It says, finally, brethren. Now, I bet we all read this scripture a million times, and we all thought, yeah, well, I need to do that, but we never made any preparation for doing it. Never made any preparation for doing it, actually. Finally, brethren, whatever things are true, whatever things are noble, whatever things are just, whatever things are pure, lovely, of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything that's praiseworthy, meditate on these things. So if a thought of lust entered our mind and took control of our mind and we began to think about it, immediately what we need to have is a list of things to think about instead. So If you want to follow this program, make a list. What things are true? Because you want to be able to think about true things instead of whatever it is that you're thinking about that's going to cause you to sin. Whatever things are noble. Do you have a list of noble things? Do you have perhaps a list of things that people have done? Noble people. Whatever things are just. Has there been something in the news or something that you read about or heard about? We say that turned out just right. That was perfect. Make a list of these things. Whatever things are lovely. There's a billion things in nature to think about that are lovely. We built a pergola last year, and I'm retired now, so I've been sitting out in it all summer. And I have hanging baskets of, what are those things? Petunias. And I've got on the pergola, and I've got over there, I've got a butterfly garden full of wildflowers. And got hummingbird feeders. And over there on the other side, I've got a feeder full of stuff that woodpeckers like to come and eat. And there's even chipmunks running around on the ground picking up seeds. This one chipmunk, he picked up a bunch of sunflower seeds that had fallen on the ground when I was filling up the bird feeders. And I picked up one of the cushions on the couch outside, and there was about 30 sunflower seeds under it. And I knew I didn't put them there, and the birds didn't put them there. And the only conclusion I could come to was that the chipmunk had put them there. And I thought, well, that little idiot, does he think that maybe, you know, some animals bury things and then forget about them? I thought, does he think that that's a safe place to hide his sunflower seeds? So I came back in the evening, and they were all gone. And it occurred to me what he was doing. He was picking up as many sunflower seeds that I had spilled on the ground as he possibly could, and he was hiding them from the birds. He couldn't carry them back to his burrow all at one time. So he had found a temporary hiding place. He hid all those sunflower seeds under one of the cushions on the couch outside, and then went at a convenient time, he went back, and he took them all into his burrow. So I'm sitting out on my deck and under my pergola, and I'm watching hummingbirds, and I'm watching a lot of goldfinches and woodpeckers. I've seen three different kinds of woodpeckers. And last week, I was sitting there reading early in the morning, and I heard a crack right by my ear, and a small bird flew that far from my head, and following it was a hawk. Sitting out in the middle of nature, just seeing all this stuff, this is beauty. This is the beauty that God's created. And for my money, there's nothing more enjoyable than watching hummingbirds and woodpeckers and butterflies. I have a butterfly garden. Saw something last week I've never seen before. It was a zebra swallowtail. I can't draw it for you, but it's a big butterfly about that big, and its wings are black with white bands going through the wings. And I had never seen one of those before. I had to look it up to see what it was, and it was a zebra swallowtail. So whatever things are lovely, whatever things are of good report, if there's any virtue, if there's anything praiseworthy, meditate on these things. Just trying to stop thinking about something you shouldn't doesn't always work. We need to divert our mind. Our mental process is to think about something else. You can't empty your mind of thoughts for a long time, but you can fill your mind with thoughts of good things. So, what are you going to think about in these times of stress, when you're stressed and when you're trying to prevent sin? Think about your family. Think about your blessings. Think about the kingdom of God. Think about your husband or the wife who's faithful to you. This is like having a fire extinguisher ready. You know, we put a wood stove in the basement, and the first thing we put down there was a fire extinguisher. My mother-in-law is terrified of the wood stove. She's the kind of person that unplugs all the appliances before she goes to bed for fear, you know, the VCR is going to burst into flames, right? But you got to have a fire extinguisher in your mind. So you need a list of things to think about, things that are noble, things that are praiseworthy, things that are beautiful. And these are the things we need to think about instead. And this is how we prevent sin from taking root in our minds. So, It's human nature to dredge up unclean things out of our hearts. And there's probably not a person in here who hasn't done that. And we live in a world that's designed to encourage lust, the lust of the eyes, the lust of flesh, and the pride of life. For the Christian, this world is filled with death traps, and we must control our minds so that sexual lust does not take root in our hearts. We must have a covenant with our eyes, as Job did. In order to be the kind of people that Jesus wants to spend time with, to be friendly with, we must manage what comes out of our hearts. So the bottom line is that if you're standing on the corner watching the girls go by, yeah, you can't go to jail for what you're thinking, but you could go to the lake of fire. So that ends that portion of the Sermon on the Mount. And I have just a short presentation to give you now about the next thing that Jesus said. Still in the theme of, you are my friends if you do whatever I have commanded you. So I want to tell you a story. It was 1975, and at that time the Baltimore Colts still played in Baltimore, and the games always began at 2:05. And about 1:50, I was eagerly waiting. This is someday in November. I was eagerly waiting for the game to begin. And I guess we had the blinds drawn in the living room where the TV was. All of a sudden, we heard the sound of an engine and the sound of squealing tires and then the sound of a car going into a skid. And it seemed like this skid just lasted and lasted and lasted, as if the car was skidding for 100 yards or more. And the skidding noise was terminated by the sound of a mighty crash. And I thought a car had run into the front of our house. So I grabbed my wife and I pushed her out the back door because I was sure that the front of the house was going to burst into flames. Fortunately, the car didn't hit our house, but it hit the telephone pole across the street from our house, knocking out all the power, so I didn't see the football game. That's how I know exactly what time this thing happened. Well, I called the police and I called the ambulance, and the police came and they took my name, and I tried to give the guy first aid, and his injury was somewhat serious. He had a head injury. I think he'd already had a head injury or he wouldn't have been driving that fast. But it was a big car. It was one of those, it's like a 1969 Pontiac, big silver thing, you know, put a bathtub in the back of it. It was one of those big cars from the late 60s or early 70s. So the guy got taken to traffic court, and I got summoned to go to court. And I had to testify against this guy or testify about what I had seen. And I was worried about it because I knew I was going to be asked to swear an oath. And I was going to have to say to whomever, the bailiff or the clerk of the court or whoever, that I wasn't going to swear an oath. And I knew I could affirm, but you know, I wasn't sure that would be accepted. And I was nervous about it. Because, you know, I had been watching Perry Mason and the Defenders for years, and nobody on Perry Mason ever said, I affirm that I'll tell the whole truth. Nobody ever did that. They all swore. They put their hands up in the air, they put their hand on a Bible, and they swore. So I knew I couldn't do that. Eventually, I got through it with no problem. You know, and they wanted, I think they even wanted me to put my, we sang the song, we sang Psalm 138. God, we're not supposed to swear in God's name. We're not supposed to swear on the temple. And I remember Psalm 138, verse 2, where it says, I will worship toward your holy temple and praise your name for your loving kindness and for your truth, for you have magnified your word above all your name. So God says his word is magnified above his name, and I can't swear on his name. And now they're handing me a Bible, and they want me to put my hand on the Bible and swear on his word. Well, it sounded serious to me. I didn't want to do it. So what's the deal about swearing? What's supposed to be accomplished by taking an oath? Why did people take oaths in the time of Jesus Christ and before? And why did Jesus tell us not to take oaths? Well, that's part of what he told us. So if we want to be his friends, we have to understand what he's talking about and obey it. So let's examine Jesus' command. We should not take oaths. What is an oath? The Wycliffe Bible Encyclopedia says, an oath is an appeal by word or act to confirm the truth of one's statement or the fulfillment of a promise. So here's an example. Let's turn over to Genesis, verse 22. Abraham is having difficulties with the indigenous people in the area where he's been told to go live. Genesis 22, verse 21. It came to pass that Abimelech and Phicol, the commander of his army, spoke to Abraham, saying, God is with you in all that you do. Therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, with my offspring, or with my posterity, but according to the kindness that I have done to you, you will do to me in the land which you dwelt. And Abraham said, I will swear. So he wanted Abraham to swear by God. So an oath sworn by men is a solemn appeal to God to confirm the truth of their word, carrying the express implication of punishment in the case of failure to speak the truth or fulfill the promise. Now, Abraham had a concern. He wanted to find a son for Isaac, and he didn't want it to be one of the indigenous people in the land. He didn't want it to be a Philistine or a Hittite. And he sent his servant out on a mission. This is Genesis 24, verse 3. This is just to give you some historical context for the history of oaths. So Abraham said to the oldest servant of his house, who ruled over all that he had, please put your hand under my thigh, and I will make you swear by the Lord of God, the Lord, the God of heaven, and the God of the earth, that you will not take a wife for my son from the daughters of the Canaanites among whom I dwell. Now, this is a quote from a book called The New Manners and Customs of the Bible. And bearing in mind, Abraham wanted his servant to put his hand under his thigh. It says here that the word thigh, the Hebrew word yarek, is a euphemism. That's a mild or indirect word that's substituted for one that's considered to be harsh, blunt, or offensive. Without question, the servant's hand was placed beneath Abraham's procreative organs. Whether the placement of the hand had to do with the act of circumcision instituted by God and thus gave it a covenant solemnity to the oath is not known. It has been said by some that it had reference to the long-range effects of the servant's mission that would have been upon Abraham's descendants, or that symbolized that even his yet unborn children would avenge any violation of the act. So that's what Abraham meant when he said to his servant, put your hand under my thigh. As a note, Joseph also said this to the children of Israel, making them swear that they would remove his bones when they left Egypt and take them back to Canaan. From the Wycliffe Bible Encyclopedia, oaths were commonly made by lifting the hand to God. So when you go to court and they say, raise your right hand, you're pointing to God. You're making an appeal to God to be a part of this transaction, a part of this oath. Oaths were commonly made by lifting the hand to God, and in exceptional cases by placing the hand, quote, under the thigh or scrotum of him to whom the oath was taken. This would be a solemn way of signifying that if the oath was violated, one's descendants would avenge the act of disloyalty. So, an oath taken in the name of God was supposed to make God a partner in the transaction or in the testimony. You remember how you've heard it a dozen times. Those of you who are old enough to have watched Perry Mason, they would make the guy put his left hand in the Bible and hold his hand up in the air, and the bailiff would say to him, do you swear to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God? And that was part of the process to make God a partner in the transaction. In ancient Israel, to solemnify and give validity to an oath, sometimes they were given before the altar. Sometimes a man would swear on his life, on his head. He would swear by Jerusalem, by the temple, by heaven, or by earth. And the main idea of an oath is to make God a part of the transaction. And with the idea that if the oath was violated, there would be an explicit curse, or sometimes the oath was implicit that there would be a curse. Genesis 21 is an example given by one of the commentaries of an implicit curse, a curse that's implied but not directly stated. Genesis 21, verse 22, came to pass at that time that Abimelech, and this is the same thing, we read before. Now, therefore, swear to me by God that you will not deal falsely with me, my offspring, or my posterity, according to the kindness I have done to you, and that you will do to me in the land in which you have dwelt. And Abraham said, I will swear. So there's implicitly, there's a curse in that oath. But here's one that's explicit. This is Joshua 6 and verse 26. This is after the destruction of Jericho. Joshua charged them at that time, saying, charged Israel, cursed be the man before God who raises up and builds this city Jericho. He shall lay its foundation with his firstborn, and with his youngest he shall set up the gates. So there's an explicit curse. And this is an oath that Joshua required of all Israel. All Israel had to take this oath. And the idea was, in ancient Israel and up to the time of Christ, that God was the guarantor of oaths when his name was invoked. Here's an example. 1 Kings chapter 2. This is the deal here is that David has died and Solomon is the king, but there's some palace intrigue and Adonijah was kind of jockeying for position. He wanted to be the king instead of Solomon, and he you remember the Shunammite, what was her name, that was given to David when he couldn't get warm? Abishag. Remember Abishag? She had never been David's wife, but she had been in bed with him just to keep him warm. It said that David never knew her. But to take the former king's wife was kind of a way of giving credibility to one's claim to the throne. And Adonijah went to Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, and asked if he could have Abishag as his wife. And Bathsheba said, well, I'll ask Solomon. She didn't get it, but Solomon got it. And he knew at that point that Adonijah was angling. He was trying to strengthen his bid, his case to be the king of Israel. And when he heard this, then Solomon swore by the Lord, saying, and he made an oath, and he invoked the name of God, and he said, may God do to me and more also, if Adonijah has not spoken this word against his own life. Now, therefore, as the Lord lives, who has confirmed me and set me on the throne of David my father, who has established a house for me, as he promised, Adonijah shall be put to death today. Wow, that's a pretty solid intention, isn't it? David says he's going to execute Adonijah, and he also swears an oath before God, the curse of which would be his own death if Adonijah did not die that day. So that's a kind of an overview of oaths that were taken from antiquity up until the time of Jesus Christ. And as I said, the main thing was that in invoking the name of God, one made God a partner in the testimony or in the transaction or the deal that was sealed by that oath. However, by the time of Christ, the taking of oaths had been grossly perverted. There was a tricky system of making an oath in which the oath that one made could be binding or non-binding. You could take an oath that was non-binding. How about that? I promised to do something, but my fingers are crossed, right? All oaths were absolutely binding, unless it was a non-binding oath. There was an art form in taking oaths that were not binding, and one had to be careful in order not to accept a non-binding oath. Oaths were only binding if certain things were invoked. For instance, the name of God. The name of God was still, if you invoked the name of God, that was still binding. If you swore by the gold of the temple, that was binding. But if you swore by the temple itself, that was non-binding. So you could say, well, Brad, I promised to pay you back that $5,000 I borrowed from you, and I swear this by the temple itself. Well, Brad said, okay, great. Wait a minute. And Brad remembers, an oath sworn by the temple is not binding. No deal. No deal. So you had to be careful that the man whom you were trusting was swearing a binding oath or a non-binding oath. You could swear by the gift on the altar, and the Jews figured that was binding. But if you swore by the altar itself, that was non-binding. And it was legitimate to break non-binding oaths. And this approach made a total mockery of the process of swearing oaths. Let's turn to Matthew 23 and verse 16. Because Jesus pointed out how meaningless and how perverted oath-taking had become. Matthew 23, 16 says, "Woe to you, blind guides, who say, 'Whoever swears by the temple, it's nothing. But whoever swears by the gold of the temple, he is obliged to perform it.' Fools and blind, what's greater, the gold of the temple that sanctifies the gold, or the temple that sanctifies the gold? And whoever swears by the altar, that's nothing. But whoever swears by the gift that's on it, he is obliged to perform it. Therefore, he says, fools and blind guides, for which is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifies the gift? Therefore, who swears by the altar swears by it and all things on it. He who swears by the temple swears by it and by him who dwells on it. And he who swears by heaven swears by the throne of God and by him who sits on it." So this period around the time of Christ was marked by an extraordinary amount of frivolous and deceptive oath-taking. And yet God was asked to be a part of this deceptive practice. I had a friend several years ago who I used to drive to work with him, so I spent a considerable amount of time with him. And in the normal course of things, he'd just talk. But occasionally, he'd say, "Now, I'll be honest with you," or "to tell the truth," or "honestly." And I thought, well, do I discount everything he said that doesn't contain one of these? It made me wonder if he was lying to me all the time. He didn't use one of those expressions. Jesus' point is that there's no need for an honest person to reaffirm continuously his honesty by taking oaths. A proliferation of oath-taking devalues what he says, devalues such statements. It was notorious for the art of oaths to be made in the time of Christ with the intent of evasion and deception. The manner in which they were taking oaths was born of deceitfulness. An honest man would never make a promise with a deliberate intention of evading it. And Christ's point in Matthew 5, which we'll read in a second, was that the idea of evasion was hypocritical and should be foreign to an honest man. So his instruction to us in regard to oaths is that we should not use them by any means. Here's his comment in Matthew 5, his command in Matthew 5, verse 34. Again, let's turn there. This is part of the Sermon on the Mount that we're concentrating on today. "But I say to you, do not swear at all, neither by heaven, for it's God's throne, nor by the earth, for it's his footstool, nor by Jerusalem, for it's the city of the great king. Nor shall you swear by your head, because you can't make one hair black or white. But let your yes be yes, and your no be no, for whatever is more than this is from the evil one." So God abolished his involvement in swearing. He was no longer going to be the guarantor of promises made by men. The abuse of oath-taking caused God to stop it entirely. It's repeated in James 5 and verse 12. James 5 and verse 12 says, "But above all, my brethren, do not swear, either by heaven or earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no be no, lest you fall into judgment." So if we invoke heaven or earth or Jerusalem in an oath, we are invoking the name of God, and we risk breaking the third commandment. Don't take the name of the Lord your God in vain. And I'm sure that many, many times the oaths that were sworn were breaking the third commandment. They were taking God's name in vain because God wasn't going to be a party to a deceptive oath. Going beyond a simple yes or no and invoking God's name in our statements is wrong. Jesus forbids it. God is aware of everything we say, and Christ is living in us. And if the Holy Spirit is guiding us, then we don't need to swear. Everything that we say should be true. Now, in 1973, we had to go and apply for a marriage license. And we didn't know this was going to happen. We had to fill out a form, and then the clerk wanted us to swear that everything that we said was true. And we said, well, we're not going to swear, we'll affirm. So she says, all right, hold up your right hands and affirm that everything said, da-da-da-da-da. Well, I still didn't want to hold up my right hand. I did. We couldn't get out of it. She was being pretty hard line, and I didn't know what I know about taking oaths at the time, and I've often wondered if I should have said to her, well, I don't want to raise my right hand. Maybe I could put my hand under your thigh instead. But my wife said I shouldn't have included that, but there it is. As Christians, we should have a reputation as men and women of truth. Proverbs 14, verse 5, it seems like a duh. I don't believe it said that. Why would you take up space in the Bible writing this? It says, a faithful witness does not lie, but a false witness will utter lies. Well, duh. Yeah. Here's the point. A man who has shown by his conduct in the past that he is a faithful witness can be trusted to give true testimony. But a man who by his previous conduct has shown that he's a false witness, you can't trust his testimony, no matter how many oaths he takes. The proverb is telling us not to trust those who have proven to be liars. Once a person has ruined his credibility by lying, he can no longer be considered to be reliable, no matter what oath he takes. God hates liars. Let's turn over to Proverbs 6. God hates liars. If we are to be his friends, we must be of the truth. Proverbs 6 and verse 16. There are six things that the Lord hates. They're behaviors. And we're not going to be the friends of God if we engage in these behaviors. Six things does the Lord hate. Yes, seven are an abomination to him. A proud look, a lying tongue. He hates a lying tongue. He's not going to be friends with a man with a lying tongue. Hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, and a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. So God is not going to be friends with a false witness who speaks lies, and we are speaking a lie, taking all the oaths in the world is not going to have any effect. So by the time of Christ, the custom of swearing, which had been an institution since the patriarchs, had become so perverted that Christ did away with it. Let's remember that we being Christians have Christ living in us, and we have no need to swear, but only an obligation to be truthful. A Greek named Isocrates said, a man must lead a life which will gain more confidence in him than ever an oath can do. And that's a different way to say a faithful witness does not lie, but a false witness will utter lies. So if we are to be the friends of Jesus Christ, we must speak the truth. We must be known to be people of the truth. Our character and our reputation for truthfulness will endear us to Jesus Christ and cause him to desire to be and cause him to desire us as his friends.